AM is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, participating in the U of I Brown v. Board of Education commemoration with the Department of Theater presentation of Lorraine Hansberry's play, A Raisin in the Sun, opening March 11th, and with in-progress showings of work being created by performance artist Ralph Lemon to be premiered at Krannert Center. For more information, visit KrannertCenter.com.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Today we delve into the story of the final flight of the space shuttle Columbia. Our guest is veteran reporter Michael Cabbage. Michael Cabbage and fellow space journalist William Harwood are the authors of a new book about Columbia, Comcheck, The Final Flight of Shuttle Columbia. The book offers readers a gripping account of the shuttle's last flight, a flight that began January 16, 2003, and ended in disaster February 1, 2003, disintegrating as it re-entered the Earth's atmosphere, killing the crew of seven. The book also takes us inside NASA, where readers see the space agency at work, its brilliance, and its flaws. Listeners, you can join the discussion with your questions and comments. I look forward to hearing from you. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana area, the telephone number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free line, toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. W-I-L-L. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Michael Cabbage has reported on more than 40 shuttle missions and covered human spaceflight on three continents. He has been on the staff of the Orlando Sentinel since 1998. He is the paper's space editor. He also serves as a space consultant to ABC News. The book Harwood and Cabbage have written, Comcheck, The Final Flight of Shuttle Columbia, is published by the Free Press. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Michael Cabbage, thanks so much for joining me this afternoon.
My pleasure.
You were in place waiting for the return of Columbia when rather suddenly it seems you realized something wasn't right. Where were you and how was it that you knew something was wrong?
Well, that's one of those memories I have a feeling is going to be sort of etched in my mind until the day I die. It was February 1st a year ago, and for almost all missions, the Orlando Sentinel, the newspaper I work for, dispatches reporters to the shuttle landing facility at Kennedy Space Center, where we wait for the shuttle to land as it returns from orbit. And as the space reporter for the newspaper, I had been doing this for many years, and the crowd that morning was a little less than normal. It was about 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning, and a lot of people hadn't bothered to come anymore because shuttle landings were such a routine event. It was the launches that everyone worried about, and no one seemed terribly interested or concerned about re-entries and landing these days. But it was a beautiful February morning. Everything seemed just very routine. The weather looked pretty good. There was a fog bank that evaporated earlier that morning, and so there were no concerns or no issues of any sort. And about 16 minutes before landing, the crew of Columbia was returning a call from Mission Control in Houston when the communications dropped out. And the flight controllers at Johnson Space Center tried for several minutes to restore those communications, and they couldn't do so. And as we were sitting around the shuttle landing facility, there's actually a blockhouse there where the public affairs officers were. And inside there's a television set. And when I walked in and looked at this television set, there's a map of the continental United States which shows the shuttle's flight path as it comes to Florida. And the shuttle's position is designated on this map by this red triangle. And that red triangle remained frozen over central Texas. It wasn't moving anywhere. And that was something none of us had ever seen before. And the communications dropout, which they're very common during reentry, they typically last only a few seconds, though, a matter of seconds. And this one went on for 1 minute, then 2 minutes, then 3 minutes, and then 4 minutes. And somewhere around 9:05, a lot of people started to worry a lot and become convinced that there was something very wrong here.
Yeah. When you learned, in fact, that the shuttle had met with disaster, what were your first thoughts?
Well, as a reporter, my first thoughts, of course, were I need to let my my editors know, and I need to immediately put in place the plan that we had talked about for many years and put together about what happens if there is another shuttle accident or shuttle disaster. It's one of those things that before every mission you talk about what you're going to do if such a thing does happen, but you hope that you're never going to have to break it out, although somewhere in the back of your mind, I guess, and I know my co-author Bill Harwood feels the same way, you approach this sort of beat, the space beat and covering the shuttle with an attitude of, you know, it's not really a question of if, it's a question of when, because in an endeavor that's as risky and as dangerous as human spaceflight, you're going to have accidents. But the first thing that crossed my mind, obviously, was talking to the people at my newspaper. And then beyond that, it was just this incredible sort of, you know, surreal feeling about what went wrong, and looking across the way at the families and a lot of the NASA officials who were there who still hadn't fully grasped what was going on, and just this this unbelievable atmosphere of uncertainty and concern and not knowing what comes next.
Yeah. The families of the seven astronauts, how were they cared for in the immediate aftermath by the folks there at the Kennedy Space Center?
Well, each of the astronaut families has an astronaut that is assigned to them, that is their sort of guide and the person who explains to them what's going on at various points in the mission, whether it's launch or landing or whatever. And as soon as these people started to get an inkling that there was something very wrong here, they immediately rounded up the astronaut families, and they took them in the fleet almost of SUVs over to Kennedy Space Center's operation and checkout building, which is the same building where the crew quarters are, where the astronauts suit up before flight, and if you've ever seen the mission coverage where they walk out and get on the van and go to the launch pad. And it was in the crew quarters that the families first got the news that it looked like there had been something very, very bad that had happened over Texas, that there were reports that the shuttle had broken apart, and that it appeared from the altitude and the speed that the shuttle was traveling at that the accident probably was not survivable. And you can only imagine, you know, if the sort of reaction that these people had, you know, much the same as any of us would have if our loved ones had been there. And it wasn't very long after that the president called and spoke to some of the families. And it was just a period of time when they were sort of left alone to grieve. But they did get as much support from NASA and NASA's astronaut corps as they could give them at that time.
Mm. A moment ago, you mentioned that you know, there weren't a lot of people around for the landing of Columbia on that February 1st morning last year, because landing was sort of seen as, well, not as dangerous as liftoff. But landing also is quite a dangerous part of the mission. Liftoff and landing are very dangerous phases of flight. Maybe you would take a moment here and tell us why this is so.
Sure. Well, launch, it's sort of self-evident, you know, why the danger is there. And of course, our memories of the Challenger accident are still fresh in many people's minds. That was 18 years ago, 17 years before the Columbia accident. And when you've got these incredible amounts of rocket fuel and human beings sitting on top of that, and you're essentially blasting them into space, there are prodigious amounts of energy that are required for that, and obviously that carries with it a great deal of danger. And everybody always knew that launch was something that shouldn't be taken lightly. I mean, when you see human beings, again, being blasted on top of a rocket 200 miles up, it's pretty apparent that there's a lot of things that can go wrong. And we saw those things firsthand in 1986 when Challenger exploded. But landing was always looked at as much more sort of, I hate to use the word routine, but in fact it had almost become routine. The Russians would argue with that because the only two fatal accidents that the Russians have ever had, both were during landing. In fact, they've never lost anyone during a launch accident. But here in the United States, the only in-flight fatalities we'd ever had, of course, were the Challenger accident. And the shuttle had seemed awfully reliable when it came to reentry and landing over the years. NASA officials thought they understood all of the forces, you know, that were at work there, and that the thermal protection system that protects the shuttles when they reenter the Earth's atmosphere, that it was well designed and durable and tough enough to withstand that. And they're just, we'd gotten to a point in 2003, 22 years after the first shuttle launch, when we didn't worry about that anymore. It truly had become an almost routine sort of event, and typically the major concerns on those sorts of mornings when you were expecting the shuttle to come home was, would the weather hold up? You know, would the weather cooperate and allow the astronauts to have a good field of vision and a good view of the landing site and that sort of thing? But as far as wondering or worrying about whether or not the shuttle itself was going to be able to survive reentry, I don't think hardly anybody really seriously worried about those sorts of issues.
Yeah. This was a figure that struck me as just so impressive, Michael, when I was reading ComCheck, that I had to pause. Columbia's last voyage was 6.6 million miles, making 255 orbits around the planet. And they're moving, of course, at an incredible speed. And, you know, no matter how we take care of the family car, we're never going to see 6 million miles. What kind of preparations, can you give us some sense, what kind of preparations are made to prepare a spaceship for a trip of millions of miles?
Well, of course, after the space shuttle comes home from every flight, it goes into its hangar at Kennedy Space Center, which is also called the OPF, to use one of NASA's many acronyms, the Orbiter Processing Facility. And inside the OPF, it undergoes weeks' worth of work in which technicians will inspect or refurbish virtually every part of the vehicle. And one of the parts that always is looked at is the thermal protection system. These thousands of tiles on the orbiter's belly that protect it from the 3,000-degree temperatures during reentry, and the panels on the leading edge of the wings and on the nose, which are made of a reinforced carbon-carbon material, which also undergo just incredible amounts of heat when the shuttle reenters. And that entire process typically takes weeks for technicians to complete all of their work. But between each flight, there is an amazing amount of work that does go on to make sure everything is ready to fly. And periodically, every 2 or 3 years, the shuttle also is sent for what they call the orbiter maintenance and modification period, in which they do essentially a complete overhaul to update systems and to make sure everything is still working properly, which is even more intensive than the sort of routine overhauls that you get between missions. So there is a great deal of work and effort that does go into making sure that the shuttles continue to fly safely and that they're ready to go for each mission. And it's significantly more than all of us put into our cars that we drive.
Yeah, yeah. Journalist Michael Cabbage is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He and fellow reporter William Harwood are the authors of ComCheck, The Final Flight of Shuttle Columbia. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments in the Champaign-Urbana area. The telephone number is 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and 800-222-WILL. Michael Cabbage is on the staff of the Orlando Sentinel. He's been on the staff of the paper since 1998. He's the paper's space editor. He also serves as a space consultant to ABC News. Michael, in a moment I'll ask you to summarize what happened to Columbia. But first I want to share with listeners comments made by the wife of Columbia's pilot, Willie McCool. Lonnie McCool has said, "I truly believe in what Willie and our crew were accomplishing as explorers, but the reasons that the CABE, that's the Columbia Accident Investigation Board, the reasons the CABE report gave for the Columbia's tragic end were not acceptable risks. The vehicle should not have launched, and our loved ones did not have to die." Is Lonnie McCool correct? Could this disaster have been prevented or averted?
I think so. I mean, obviously, we have the benefit of 2020 hindsight now to look back at that, and that's a very strong statement. But I think it's not without some justification. One of the things that struck me in the aftermath of writing this book, or in the aftermath of the accident when we began writing the book, was the extent to which two missions before Columbia's launch, they had a similar problem with Shuttle Atlantis, where a big piece of foam insulation that covers the gigantic external fuel tank that holds the liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen that the shuttle's main engines burn on the way to orbit. A big piece of the insulation that covers that tank came off during launch and struck a part of the shuttle. Now, in Atlantis' case, which was in October 2002, several months before Columbia's January 2003 launch, it hit one of the twin solid rocket boosters, the pencil-shaped-looking boosters that are attached to either side of the tank during launch. In Columbia's case, it hit the leading edge of the left wing, and as we know now, it created a hole in the leading edge of the left wing that allowed these super hot gases to get in during reentry and destroy the wing from the inside out. But there was a critical discussion that happened after the Atlantis launch when the flight readiness review for another mission that occurred between the Atlantis mission and the Columbia mission took place, in which NASA managers got together and they looked at the foam strike that had hit Atlantis, and they considered whether or not it was serious enough to go off and fix, or to make it sort of a hurdle for the next flight, meaning they would have to figure out a way to fix the problem before the next shuttle would fly. And in the end, they decided that the problem was so well understood. Foam had been coming off the tank since the very first shuttle flight, and in fact had come off every single flight of the shuttle since then. They believed the problem was not serious enough to merit grounding the fleet or taking really immediate, serious corrective action. And so they put in a longer-term study and a longer-term fix where they would try to cure this problem over the course of several missions and continue to fly the shuttle. And when Shuttle Endeavour launched in November of 2002, no foam came off the tank and no one worried about it after that. And then, of course, when Columbia launched in January of 2003, you had a very similar size piece of foam from exactly the same location on the tank as the piece of foam that had hit Atlantis come off and cause what turned out to be catastrophic damage to Columbia.
How large were these pieces of foam for Atlantis and for Columbia?
Well, the piece of foam that hit Columbia was about the size of a large briefcase, which doesn't seem to be, you know, huge in size when you consider the gigantic size of the shuttle itself. But the density, this is one of the things that really sort of NASA managers took comfort in when they saw video of the foam strike. One reason they weren't so worried is this foam essentially has the consistency of styrofoam. And the piece of foam that was believed to have hit Columbia's wing actually weighed somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 pounds, which is not a huge amount. But when you've got pieces of debris that are traveling at the amazing speeds that these were, and in fact the piece of foam actually came off and Columbia, as it climbed into orbit, rammed into it, was the way that sort of worked. You can cause a lot more damage than you might intuitively think you can, and that's certainly what happened in this case.
Yeah. Well, that piece of foam comes off Columbia at launch, and it damaged the left wing, correct?
Exactly right.
Okay. So can you give us just a brief idea, kind of a summary of what happened to Columbia then, as with that left wing damaged, it's re-entering the Earth's atmosphere?
Sure. to give you sort of the brief overview, what happened was, as Columbia began its encountering the first traces of the Earth's atmosphere, and as it began its descent through the Earth's atmosphere, the air became the friction from the air created what was almost like a blowtorch-like effect as these superheated hot gases entered this hole, which was estimated to be about 8 to 10 inches wide in the leading edge of the left wing, and began burning away the spars or the support structures inside the wing. And it began burning through wires that connected sensors and essentially starting to almost vaporize everything that was in its path. And by the time that the shuttle crossed the California coastline and began sort of its descent across from west to east, the continental United States towards Florida, it already was in very, very serious trouble. Pieces of the shuttle already were beginning to come off as parts of the shuttle wing were eaten away, and as the hole continued to grow larger and larger and larger. Finally, by the time the shuttle reached Texas, huge chunks of this wing were coming off. And somewhere around 9 o'clock Eastern time that morning, as the shuttle was 16 minutes away from landing at Kennedy Space Center, all or part of the wing broke away. And no one knows exactly for sure the sort of sequence of events that happened after that, but the larger pieces of the shuttle essentially disintegrated. And the people who were watching the shuttle reentry that morning over Texas saw what almost looks like a meteor shower as these different parts of the shuttle broke up and fell to Earth.
Earlier I mentioned the Columbia Accident Investigation Board, known as CABE, when I mentioned Lonnie McCool and what she had to say about what had happened. Tell us about this board. Was the investigation it conducted free of influence from NASA? What did the panel do to keep its distance from NASA?
Those are very good questions. And I think, in my view, and I believe Bill, my co-author, shares this view as well, in the final analysis, the board was free of influence. There was a real concern at the onset about the fact that NASA wanted to keep this review as a NASA-chartered group. They did not want the White House to form an independent panel. They didn't want Congress to form an independent panel. And there were a lot of people in Congress, and in fact a lot of people in the media, that really questioned whether or not that would work, whether that would give the board the independence that it needed to really take a long and detailed look and make hard choices and make hard recommendations. And what they didn't want was sort of an in-house group that was taking its direction from the NASA administrator, in which they really weren't looking at some of the long-term and the bigger picture issues that they would need to look at. But one of the things that happened in the course of establishing this investigation commission was NASA Administrator Sean Keefe appointed as the chairman of the investigation Admiral Hal Gaiman. Admiral Gaiman is one of the people who helped lead the investigation at the USS Cole when the terrorist explosion, if you remember that, caused a great deal of damage there and killed quite a few American servicemen. And Admiral Gaiman is the sort of person who, largely almost through the strength of his personality and through what he brought to the investigation, guaranteed that it would not become sort of an in-house investigation where the investigators were sort of the lapdogs of NASA. And they did a tremendous job, I think, of going out and looking not only at the immediate causes of the accident, how the foam came off the external fuel tank and where it hit the shuttle and the physical causes of the accident, but also the much bigger picture questions that caused the accident, like the collapse of NASA's safety culture, like poor communications and bad management techniques and that sort of thing. And in the final result, I think they really did one of the most sweeping, comprehensive reviews of NASA that's ever been done, and I think just about everyone has given really high marks to the Accident Investigation Board for the report that they finally came out with.
Yeah. I think that perhaps for you and your co-author, William Harwood, that Gaiman might be one of the most unforgettable characters in the story.
There's no question. Gaiman is one of those rare individuals who sort of he leads by example, and he immediately commands respect from the people who work with him almost effortlessly without even trying to do so. He immediately took this board and gave them sort of a camaraderie and a purpose that was really something to see watching this whole process unfold from the outside. He's a remarkable man. He's an incredibly bright man, and he's also someone who people who know him and people who worked with him say is incredibly fair and opened up the process to where everyone's voices were heard and they reached a consensus on what happened. But by the same token, there was never any question that he was the person in charge and that this was Admiral Gaiman's investigation. And I think the leadership that he showed in making this investigation come together is one of the main reasons that the quality of the report turned out as well as it did.
Hmm. Michael Cabbage, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's the space editor for the Orlando Sentinel. He is co-author with William Harwood of ComCheck, The Final Flight of Shuttle Columbia. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. We have a listener waiting to talk with us in Chicago on line 4. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
NASA's been blamed for mismanagement of the Columbia deal and in general for mismanagement of the entire project. That's a bit overblown. I've gotten from word from a person who is a long-time employee of NASA. He's no longer working for them, that the investigation of the Columbia probably was a whitewash, and this is because of the fact that over the years, commercial interests have gotten control of NASA, the running of NASA, basically, and so much so that in the case that he cites for himself and a number of other engineers who worked with him in NASA were not allowed to visit the site of the vehicles and that sort of thing to inspect the vehicles and to do other sort of engineering work that was necessary. And they were ordered off of the site by the people who were running the project, and this was a commercial interest. And basically, this person tells me that although he wasn't working with NASA at the time, it was his best guess that there was a whitewash there, and the blame for the disaster was kept from that of the commercial interest. They weren't brought into the picture at all.
Well, that's an interesting perspective, and let me tell you what my understanding is. I think there's no question you've touched on something here, in that the only people that were responsible for this accident weren't the civil servants who work for the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. Over the last several years, there's been a process in the shuttle program where many responsibilities, including many safety oversight responsibilities, have slowly been transferred from civil servants and from the government over to the private sector. And in fact, there is a prime contractor for the shuttle's daily operations and the shuttle program, United Space Alliance, that is a partnership between Boeing and Lockheed Martin that essentially runs the day-to-day operations of the shuttle program. And one of the things that the Columbia Accident Investigation Board found, which I guess would sort of contradict what your source of information or your friend was telling you, is that they looked at this very hard, and they came to the conclusion, in fact, that the shuttle contractors did not exercise, you know, they were not held to the scrutiny that they should have been, and that in fact, the blame didn't rest solely with the government. Now, the report did not go into great detail on the, you know, what the contractors did or how they might have been to blame, but there's no question one of the fundamental findings of the report was that NASA's oversight of the contractors was much more lax than it should have been, and that the leaving safety in the hands of the contractors without having adequate oversight was not something that served the shuttle program well.
Let me go one step further and that is that the person who gave me this information or his opinions told me that when the engineers brought the difficulties they had with the contractors to the attentions of the higher up, they were told to do what the higher ups tell you, do what these commercial people tell you to do. If they tell you to stay away from the project, stay away, so that if anything goes wrong, NASA will not be blamed.
I haven't heard of anything like that. I do know that there were at Kennedy Space Center in Florida, one of the accident investigation board members actually put an addendum onto the board's report, which talked about some of the concerns they had in shuttle processing at Kennedy Space Center, namely that there were no unscheduled inspections where government people would come in; they would just drop in to see what the contractors were doing. And in fact, they had to give advance notice to the contractors before they would even come in and inspect to see what was going on. And in one case, there was hardware that was actually installed on the shuttle for launch that was not flight hardware. It was meant to only for the ground, and it was only meant for testing, but it was nevertheless installed as flight hardware. And those are some of the things that made a lot of people really nervous on the board when they started seeing these things. And it's sort of similar to what you're talking about. I don't know of cases where people were actually told, to leave or to be quiet, but I do know that in fact there were hurdles for some of the NASA safety inspectors at the Cape especially that made it difficult for them to exercise the kind of oversight over the contractors that a lot of people felt was necessary.
I want to thank the caller for his call this afternoon. To follow up on his questions and comments, you quote a sociologist in the book who wrote about Challenger, and this sociologist wrote a book about the Challenger disaster, and she cited, quote, an incremental descent into poor judgment supported by a culture of high-risk technology. And after the Columbia disaster, some people at NASA started reading that book. And they were saying in the aftermath of Columbia, this is Challenger all over again.
The parallels are almost scary when you really sort of step back and look at them. In both cases, you had intense schedule pressures were causing people to perhaps go a little more quickly and do things that maybe they shouldn't have. And in Challenger's case, it was to meet an unrealistic launch schedule. In Columbia's case, it was to continue construction of the International Space Station. You had bad communications between management and engineers who were at lower levels. In both cases, lower-level engineers thought that there was an issue that needed to be explored more fully, that they were very concerned about, and those concerns either were not heard or were ignored when they got up to the people at the top of the program. And there are no question similarities between the two. And the sociologist you mentioned, Diane Vaughan, I think she helped really crystallize the sort of groupthink that characterized not only the Columbia accident but the Challenger accident as well, and showed how after making a lot of efforts in the wake of the Challenger accident to sort of fix some of those things, that NASA eventually kind of went back to its old bad habits. And one of the real challenges for NASA in the future is going to be to figure out, number one, how do you measure changes in people's attitudes and their mindset? How do you reform something like a culture, a safety culture? How do you institute long-term reforms in the way that people think? That's a real challenge. And the other thing is a real problem is, how do you measure your progress? How do you know that these sorts of things are taking taking hold, and ultimately, how do you make sure that 10 years from now or 5 years from now, if you're still launching the shuttle, and in fact the shuttle is supposed to be retired now sometime between 2010 and 2012, but how do you ensure that, you know, if you insert these reforms and they start to take hold and people start to make these changes, and for the next couple of flights everything is fine, you know, how do you guarantee that people still have that same sense of urgency and that same attention to detail 4 years from now as they will when the shuttle returns to flight next year? I mean, those are all huge questions.
Yeah. I have a couple of other callers who are on the line waiting for us, but before we, I want to get to them very quickly, but before we do that, the first caller we heard from this afternoon in Chicago also, you know, raised this issue of the contractors, and we're at a time and a place where we're seeing a lot of government, a lot of things that the government did, both at NASA and in the military, turning to the private sector for those services. And I wonder if you've given any thought to this, and what are your thoughts about that?
Well, I have, and as you undoubtedly know, in the 1980s and in the 1990s, one of the big things that sort of became in vogue was to turn over as much, for government to turn over as much as possible to industry and to the private sector as far as, you know, operational tasks and those sorts of things. And that wasn't only in the space program. As you mentioned, it also happened in the Defense Department. It's happened across the board, pretty much. And in NASA, that transition was especially stark. You went from a shuttle program that had civil servants, you know, virtually every part of the chain, to a program that the way it's currently set up is about 10% NASA civil servants over and about 90% private sector people, contract employees. And there have been a lot of people, not only in the wake of the Columbia accident, but even before, that questioned whether we had gone too far too fast and whether perhaps too much of these responsibilities were turned over to the private sector and whether they were giving the adequate oversight that they needed, whether we had enough government inspectors looking over their shoulder, whether we had enough sort of checks and balances to make sure that when they were trying to institute reforms and efficiencies to gain more cost effectiveness and to generate profit, frankly, that we weren't sacrificing things like safety. And those are questions that I don't think have been fully answered yet. I mean, those are things that a lot of people need to really look at very carefully. And I think it's going to be interesting in the days and weeks and years to come to see sort of how that issue shakes out.
Let's talk with another listener, a caller in Urbana on line one. Good afternoon.
Yeah, I have three questions. One is, I understood that Columbia was one of the oldest shuttles, but would you say that in general the age of the Columbia was not part of the problem?
I would say the age of Columbia was not part of the problem. Again, these things are painstakingly maintained, and in fact, each shuttle has supposedly a lifetime of about 100 missions in it, or at least they were originally designed with that in mind. And Columbia is only about a quarter of the way through its expected lifetime, if you go by that measuring stick. So I don't think that was really an issue.
Okay. And the other thing is, or I have two other questions. One is, am I to understand that the leading edge of the shuttle's wing was not expected to take a hit from a 2-pound projectile, or not?
The rule is that no debris is supposed to come off the shuttle's external fuel tank and strike any part of the orbiter. That's the official requirement, but in fact it had been happening ever since the beginning of the program, although typically the pieces of foam that came off the tank were much smaller than the one that hit the leading edge of Columbia's wing. When people reviewing the videos after launch saw this happen, I mean, they were stunned by the shower of particles, the spray that this captured, and I mean, it was a pretty spectacular sight. But even so, most people did not think, because of the toughness of this reinforced carbon-carbon material, that a 2-pound chunk of, again, what has the same feel and consistency of styrofoam, that a 2-pound chunk of styrofoam could knock a hole in this. But they were wrong. the velocity of the relative velocities of the impact and the energy, you know, that was imparted in the leading edge of the wing knocked a hole, investigators believe, that was 8 to 10 inches across. And that was the end of the shuttle right there.
Yeah, I'm surprised they didn't test its vulnerability. But anyway, my last question is, I was reading an article in Popular Science, and in it they say that the amount spent by the Department of Defense on space is greater than the amount spent by NASA, which makes me wonder all sorts of things. Like, for example, does that mean that that the Department of Defense people are at the Kennedy Space Center pushing aside the NASA people? Is there some sort of conflict there? Are they, you know, for turf or whatever? You know, and can you talk in general about the Department of Defense's space programs and how it may impact NASA? And I'll hang up. Thanks.
Sure. Traditionally, NASA has been a strictly civilian agency, and in fact, when NASA was founded in 1958, October 1st, 1958, it was sort of carved out of existing projects that the military had going on, and was designed to be a very public, very civilian space agency, which it always has been throughout its history. Now, that doesn't mean that there isn't a great deal of interaction with the military, and in fact, Kennedy Space Center is adjacent to Cape Canaveral Air Force Station, which, of course, is an Air Force installation that many of the defense satellites that orbit the Earth that are used for military purposes are launched from. So it's always been more of a cooperative effort than one that's sort of where you've got any tension or friction there. There really is not a huge military presence per se on the NASA side over at Kennedy Space Center. I mean, again, there is a lot of sort of synergy, to use a word that was popular a few years ago, between the two. And increasingly, especially the Bush administration has looked for ways in which they can increase the sort of cooperation that goes on between the public or civil space area and the military space area. Because, after all, you use the same sort of technologies to put military missions in space or civil missions into space, and that sort of thing. But there really wasn't a situation where you had any kind of a conflict at Kennedy Space Center or anywhere else on the NASA side that I'm aware of between military people and NASA people, where you had a military agenda that was somehow coming in conflict with civil space skills.
Okay, I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon. We just have barely a minute or two left here in this part of the program, and so we're not going to be able to get to all the phone calls we've got this afternoon. I've got a couple of questions, though, that I think are important to wrap up with this afternoon. How has this affected the people on the ground who work at NASA and who were working at the time that of the Columbia disaster? Are they still with NASA?
Many of them are, although there is sort of a, beyond the profound sadness they all felt in the wake of the accident, there's a lot of uncertainty there. President Bush came out in January with his vision for the sort of future of NASA and human spaceflight in America. And part of that long-term plan calls for retiring the shuttle when the International Space Station is completed sometime around 2010, 2011, 2012. And sort of to compound the sort of tragedy of Shuttle Columbia, you have a situation where a lot of people who have been in the shuttle program, some of whom helped build and design the program, they've been in it for more than a quarter century, who are looking at the end of this lifelong sort of endeavor not too far down the road. And so I guess the people on the ground, beyond the kind of shock and grief that they felt about the accident itself, now as they look to when the shuttle returns to flight next year, without knowing exactly when that's going to be either, or how long it's going to take to make the sort of fixes and reforms they need to get going again, there is this uncertainty that's out there about when they fly again and how long they'll fly after that.
Yeah. Back to the sociologist, Diane Vaughan, I thought it was very interesting that she told you that it was important not to let the heads roll. She said it keeps the institutional memory alive of what happened.
That is really interesting, isn't it? And I was struck by that also. You know, you always get the sort of the knee-jerk reaction is when you have something like this happen, that you have to make examples out of people and they have to be held accountable, and heads should roll. And in fact, there was a lot of pressure coming from Congress and coming from, in fact, many media members that the people who were involved in the mission management team during Columbia's flight, as well as some of the people who helped make the decisions before the flight ever launched, should be held accountable. But I think Vaughn's conclusion and her sort of theory is that, you know, assuming that these people didn't act in a malevolent way, you know, that they had the best interests of the mission at heart and they just made mistakes, then no one is going to learn more from a tragedy like this. And no one is going to be less likely to repeat these sorts of mistakes in the future. And by keeping them around, you also keep this institutional memory of this tragedy around, and you keep people from forgetting it and sort of backsliding in the way that we talked about earlier.
Yeah. I can only give you maybe 30 seconds here, but how is the agency sorting out where it should head next?
Well, they have a plan in place that is going to address the hardware issues that they saw in the launch and in the flight of Columbia, and they're going to try and obviously keep the foam from ever impacting parts of the shuttle the way that it did during this flight. And they're also looking at ways that they can solve some of these long-term cultural issues where they can institute management reforms through training, get better communications among the people on the ground, and in general make things better along those lines as well. So they're really they have a two-pronged sort of plan of attack. One is to fix the hardware, and the other is to fix the management.
The culture. Very good. Michael, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
My pleasure.
Michael Cabbage is the space editor for the Orlando Sentinel. He and William Harwood are the authors of ComCheck, The Final Flight of Shuttle Columbia. The book is published by the Free Press. It's 7 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Settlement prices in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Very interesting show, by the way, today, Celeste. I appreciated that greatly. Thank you very much. Let's take a look at what happened to the Chicago Board of Trade this afternoon. Pay attention, especially in the soybean pit, to the wide trading range today, about 20 to 25 cents primarily in all of those, but it was much lower than it was higher throughout the day, about 20 down or about 15 down and maybe 10 on the upside, but finished 10 lower than the highs. So pay attention to those ranges, and we'll ask Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services what all that means when we talk to him about 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock this afternoon. Now let's begin with the numbers in the wheat pit. The March futures, 392, the high, the low at 383, a settlement price there, 387 and a quarter, down 5 and a quarter. May wheat, 399, the high, low at 390 and a half, and a settlement price 4 cents lower at 394 and a half. July futures, 395 and a half, high, low at 390, settled 394, down 2 and a half. September contract, 397, the high, the low at 393, a settlement price there at 396 and a half, a penny and a half lower. In December wheat futures, 403 and a half, the high, the low at 399, settlement price at 403 and a quarter, down 2 and 3 quarters. Corn futures holding strong today, but in a very narrow trading range, actually only about 4 cents. The March contract, 292 and a half, the high, the low at 288 and a half, and a settlement price closer to the high end at 291 and three quarters, but it was just a penny higher for the day. May futures, 299 and a half, the high, the low at 295 and a half, a settlement price 298 and a half, up 3 quarters. July contract stays in a $3 range for the day, 302 the high, the low at 298 and a half, and a settlement price 301, up 3 quarters. September contract, 295 and a half, the high, the low at 292 and 3 quarters. A settlement, 294 and a half, they were unchanged. And December futures for the corn, 294 and a quarter, the high, the low at 290, settled 292 and a quarter, unchanged for the day. March contract for 05, 294 and a half, the high, the low at 292, a settlement price at 293 and a half, down a half. And the July futures, 296 and a half on the high side, the low at 294, settled 295 on that 05 July contract, unchanged for the day. December for 05, this 2-year crop year is out, 265 the high, the low at 262, settled 263 and a half, and they finished a penny higher. March oats, 154 the high, the low at 150 and a half, settled 152, up a quarter. And the May oats, 159 the high, the low at 155 and a half, settlement price there at 157 and a quarter, unchanged on the day. From the soy complex, a wide trading range exhibited here. March contract, 9-43 the high, that's 943 on the high, the low 917, settled closer to the high side at 933 and three quarters, up 4 cents for the day. May beans, 937 the high, the low at 911, settled 928, up 2. July futures 919, the high, the low at 894, a settlement price at 911.5, up 4. And the September beans 805, the high, the low at 788, and a settlement price at 802.5, up 5.5. November beans 740, the high, the low at 716, settled 732, up 5. And January contracts 735, the high, the low at 715, a settlement price at 731.5, up 5. And March futures 732, the high, the low at 722, settled 731. They finished up 4 cents for the day. The March bean meal at 282.50, the high, the low at 274.50, settled 281, up 70. The May meal 281.80, high, low at 274, settled 280.60, up 30 for the day. March bean oil 34.45, the high, the low at 33.56, a settlement at 33.83, down 27. And the May contract 34.22, the high, the low at 33.35, a settlement price 33.59, down 33. Now here's Celeste with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Thanks, Todd. Cattle were higher today, while lean hogs and bellies finished lower. March feeder cattle, 86.30 the high, 85.55 the low, 85.90 the settlement, that up 15. April, 85.40 the high, 84.70 the low, 84.80 the settlement, that unchanged. May, 86.20 the high, 85.40 the low, 86.12.5 the settlement, that up 30. August, 88.10 the high, the low 87.70, the settlement 87.87.5, that down 12.5. February live cattle 82.55 the high, 80.80 the low, 81.47.5 the settlement, that up 125. March 79 even the high, 77.80 the low, 78 even the settlement, that up 80. April 77.35 the high, 75.95. The low, low for April live cattle, 75.90, and the final price, 76.30, that up 67.5. June live cattle, 72.80 the high, 72 even the low, 72.47.5 the settlement, that up 62.5. April lean hog, 61.05 the high, 59.70 the low, 60.12.5 the settlement, that down 85. May, 61.40 the high, 60.40 the low, 60.65 the settlement, that down 55. June, 65.90 the high, 64.65 the low, the settlement 64.97.5, that down 20. July, 62.30 the high, 61.30 the low, 61.85 the settlement, that down 5. February bellies, 97.50 the high, 94.90 the low, 94.90 the settlement, that down 130. And March, 96.30 the high, 95 even the low, 95.27.5 the settlement, that down 87.5. The Dow is up 31 points, the NASDAQ 12 higher, and the S&P 500 4 higher.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Mikey Wallen from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, writes, "Dear Dr. Science, I'm so confused. What exactly is the difference between handcuffs and fisticuffs?"
Handcuffs are used after fisticuffs north of the equator. In the southern hemisphere, that order is reversed, and fisticuffs erupt only.